Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We are going to tackle what's happening around us with the attack in London, what that means, what our nation's response to it was, looking at Trump's tweets, looking at our pulling out of the Paris Accords that happened just before this attack in London, and in Trump calling for his ban. He used the word ban in his tweets, and he tweeted out things like, at least to the London mayor, at least 7 dead, 48 wounded in terror attack, and the mayor of London says there is no reason to be alarmed, exclamation point. And he writes, we have to stop being politically correct and get down to the business of security for our people. If we don't get smart, it will only get worse. And calling for his travel ban to be put in place. The Justice Department should have stayed with the original travel ban, not the watered-down politically correct version they submitted to SC, the Supreme Court, that he signed off on. So I thought about this in the context also of how deeply divided a nation we are. Now, we don't have any Trumpites on the show this morning, and we do have them on and will have them on. But I think it's interesting when I talk to people who do love and support Donald Trump about how different our views of the world are and where we're going. And if you listen to left-wing and progressive radio, you hear one set of things. If you read the Washington Times and listen to right-wing talk radio, which I try not to do because there's no reason for it. I can just read about it and learn the same. You can see how vastly different we are. So let's talk a bit about that. In studio with me is Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She is co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities, and a co-editor of Obama 101. Was that right? Obama 1.0. Excuse me. It wasn't on my sheet. That's why I was trying to make it up. Sorry. Good to see you, Kimberly.
Thank you.
Quincy Gamble joins us, who has been a Democratic Party operative and worked in our unions, done much more. Quincy, good to have you with us.
Good to talk to you, man.
Bill Fletcher Jr. joins us, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, editorial board member of blackcommentator.com. And Bill, welcome back. Good to have you with us, as always.
Always a pleasure.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. What's your favorite Trump tweet? You can let us know.
Favorite?
Huh? Well, you know, I just... So, we are a deeply divided place, Bill Fletcher. Deeply divided in terms of how we look at this world. And we can talk a bit about the politics of what has transpired with his presidency over the last week since we've talked last. But talk a bit about this, your perception of what this divide means.
Well, you know, Mark, as I've said on previous shows, this country has always been divided. We're just more conscious of it in part because of social media. I mean, you know, we were divided around slavery. I mean, you can't get much more divided than that.
Right.
And a civil war. I mean, if you look at it, there have been very, very deep divisions about what kind of country is to be built, whether to exterminate Native Americans, you know, the issue of civil rights, the issue of women's rights. I mean, it goes on and on. So it's very deeply divided. You're right. But I don't think we should look at this as a new phenomena.
Right.
Because I think that ends up taking us down the wrong path, and we end up misunderstanding the moment we're in.
And what moment do you think we're in, Kimberly?
A moment of chaos would be probably the word I could articulate off the top of my head right now. And I would say that because we are so divided, and it also feels like we're not quite sure what direction to go in. Even when we listen to Trump, we hear him tweet one thing in the morning, but by afternoon it's something else that he's tweeting. And it sounds as though they are very different directions on the same issue or different perspectives on the same issue. And so it does feel like we don't really know what direction we're going in, and that we are picking whatever is the hottest piece of an issue to tackle in that very moment, and whatever he can garner some kind of support off of in that moment is where his direction is. But as a country, I think that has just fed into what feels like chaos.
And I think, you know, and Quincy, I mean, you've been, as I said earlier, like an operative inside the Democratic Party and worked in unions and helped run unions. You've run the gubernatorial campaigns, and your sense of where this politics is taking us?
Well, I think I definitely agree with the previous guest and what Bill said, that we've always been divided as a country. I think that if you look through history, you could always have a fidelity to the core goodness of America as it related to the big picture, the big items. And I think now our politics, and I think progressives are to blame as conservatives, is we are willing to set aside everything that's sort of decently American just to support political. And what this is that we are deploying an incredible amount of damage to our global relationship. And that really supersedes whether or not Democrats and Republicans are getting along at home. We're really being tested into a situation where our foreign policy is being dramatically changed from a disposition and from words. And I just think it's a very unique moment, a very scary moment. We aren't the America, for good or for better, we're not the America that we were a year ago, and that's scary.
And let me, Quincy, we're going to hang up on you and call you right back, see if we can get a better connection. I'd be hang up on you like we're going to hang up on you. We're going to call you right back, get a better connection. But, Bill, you know, so let's just take some examples of what happened over the last week. Let's look at the at pulling out of the climate accord. Mm-hmm. And what that means. And there's many of us who, I remember when we debated this on the air, we had talked about with folks live when the negotiations were going on from Paris. We really looked at that deeply. And there were many people on our program then talking about how this climate accord really didn't get to the heart of what has to be done to save the planet we're on and to save our future. And now we have pulled out of it. And so even those who critique that are like pulling the wagons around saying we have to save it. So there are all these kind of disconnects. I think people are having a hard time figuring out just what our responses should be.
Mark, let's start with Paris, but not the Paris you're talking about.
Right.
Paris of 1940, June 1940.
Okay.
The French surrendered to the Germans and began an experiment in what was called unoccupied France. It was under the Vichy regime led by Marshal Pétain.
Right.
And in the period that they existed, the Vichyites attempted to overturn everything that the French Revolution had brought to France in 1789. Everything. And people were stunned by this because they basically had thought that the French Revolution and its results was a settled question. But it turned out that there was a significant portion of the French population that had never accepted the French Revolution and was quite prepared to reverse the prior 150 years. The same is true in the United States, Mark, that what I call the United Right Front, that is the right-wing populace as well as the conservatives, have an agenda, and the agenda is to overturn the 20th century. And they seek to turn everything back to pre-1912. And that's what they are set on doing. So, yes, there's craziness. Yes, this governor for gubernatorial candidate in Virginia is really hitting on something when he talks about Trump's narcissistic, maniacal, or whatever, being a narcissistic maniac. I get that. But the deeper problem is that there's a strong right-wing current, part of which Trump speaks for, that really wishes to overturn things. And so the division that we're dealing with is not simply that we have an idiot in the White House, although we do. It is that there's a concerted effort to turn the clock back. And what I fear is that too many people are going to be hedging their bets, hoping and praying that it will not be that bad, and not understanding that it's not only not, it's going to be worse.
So before I turn to Kimberly here, the question I just want to raise here, you mentioned 1912. Why did you say 1912?
Yeah. Because of the Progressive Era, that the reforms that you really start to see in the 20th century begin around the period of 1912, the so-called Progressive Era. and then move forward with the growth of organized labor, women gaining the right to vote, the monumental 1930s and 40s with Roosevelt and the welfare state. But it really is around 1912, and Grover Norquist, the architect of many of the anti-tax movements, was very clear when he said that we needed to return the United States to the era of William McKinley. That's 1898, Spanish-American War.
So that I wanted you to just map that out for us to get to, for the context, which I think is important. So, you know, when you think about this country, and I can sit here and talk about all of Donald Trump's tweets, and I get everybody in the media is doing it, but when you think about this country, when Europeans first came here, they were at odds and at war with the people who lived here before they stumbled onto the continent. Shortly thereafter, enslavement began, actually began earlier throughout the hemisphere, but began here in 1619. And the word and race became a phenomenon. Race became a reality. Race was a creation of part of that colonialization that took place in America. So racism was born out of that. And in some ways, it seems to me that just what thing what Bill Fletcher said earlier, Kimberly, is that we have been at war in some ways from the beginning of this country. And that we had a civil war. And that and the war before that, part of that war was the war of people trying to survive who are native, but also there was a war called the underground, called the abolition movement to end slavery. Mm-hmm. And some people meant by any means necessary, which is things like things that Harriet Tubman and John Brown and others deeply believed in. Mm-hmm. That you're either there, ready to die for it, or you were not ready to die to end this abhorrent system in this country. And so in many ways, what we're seeing is this war bubbling up. And if you looked at the front page of the New York Times, I believe it was Friday or Saturday. I don't remember which day it was. I think it was Saturday morning.
About the extremists?
The extreme right and the violent nature of the extreme right.
Yeah.
That's taking place. So let's explore this for a moment. Are we at war internally here? What does that war mean if we are?
So I haven't quite gotten to the point of saying we are at war, but I certainly believe there is an undertone to some of what's happening in this nation where race has always been a part of our conversation, whether we articulated it or not. And it does feel like we are at a precipice where something is about to occur. And I'm not sure what that looks like because we do have forces on both sides or all sides, not even just two sides, but all sides that are speaking about this issue in various ways, hoping to get to the spot where they want. And for a number of conservatives, I hadn't even thought about back to 1912, but certainly the 1950s comes to mind because that's that decade that so many conservatives speak to, right, in terms of what seemed to be working and working well in this nation. And the fact that anyone desires to return to that space also shares with you that we don't see this as a diverse nation where all people can live together, that we see it as a structure that needs to return, that we need to hit reset and return to a structure that fits and works for some people, and everyone else just deals with it.
So, Equitz, you're back with us?
I am.
I thought I heard you saying something under your breath. So what?
I was saying amen.
I guess what I'm trying to say here is I think many people kind of are lost for a strategy about how to move forward and what this means in this larger context.
But for me, you know, Mark, it's about the fact that we have lost the quality of civility to even be able to have those types of conversations. Like, I am open to the idea of sitting with the Trumpsters and discussing what vision we have for our nation. But if the only way for you to sit with me and have that conversation is to call me names and to attack the way that I live my life because that's too left-leaning for you, then that shuts down any ability for us to find progress and move towards any common goals as Americans.
But I don't think that we had civility. See, I think that there's a certain illusion. Ask Emmett Till about civility, right? I mean, I don't think that we had there was a certain kind of civility in the political class in terms of the way that they operated in Congress, for example. But when you get deeper than that, think about the lynchings. What does that say about civility?
Right.
I mean, think about the right-wing press. Think about the fact that Henry Ford, the great Henry Ford, published in the United States the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Right.
Right? Right. Think about the support for the Black Legion and the KKK by, you know, various capitalists. I think we have a certain idea that there was a normality. The normality of the United States is violence. This is a very violent country. It has the most violent record, for example, on labor-capital relations of any advanced capitalist country. Most people in the United States don't know that.
So
they don't know about... I'm not convinced that there's been some sort of qualitative difference except for one thing, and that is the introduction of social media.
Information,
so that
absolutely.
It feels like it's all-consuming. I mean, this morning I was having this tweet battle with these right-wingers, and it was absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just in completely different worlds. But I would argue that 40 years ago, we would have been in completely different worlds. It's just that we wouldn't have known each other.
That's really...
I definitely mm-hmm. agree. When I think about conversations I had with my grandfather, who would have been 87 now, had he still been alive. I remember the conversations. Yeah, I don't think that there's ever been, especially internally for Black Americans, there hasn't been civility. There has been an acceptance, or there has been incremental acceptance of how we are talked to or how we are treated in trying to get ahead. But this country has always been violent. It's always been racist. It's always been unfair to those who are not in the European majority. And it just seems like now there's much more access to information. There are many more avenues to put out your opinion. And we're just sort of in this hyper era of just information and opinions and venues and platforms to spill hate. And that's why I am not as hopeful as some are about what the next step or what the next iteration of this American experience will be. I think it's truly scary.
Yeah, I was just going to respond to Bill because I think he's right. I guess I was speaking on this level of civility that I feel like we experience anecdotally at a micro level. And I would easily say at the macro level, dealing with systems and the way in which oppression and supremacy is operated in this country from its beginning is clearly not an example of civility. But at least on a one-on-one, I can happen to be, I mean, I grew up in North Carolina. So, I mean, I'm sure there are more conservative places, but I mean, it's fairly conservative. And my family was the second Black family to decide to move into a predominantly white neighborhood. And there was still civility, like at least among neighbors that my parents knew voted differently than they did, thought about the world and race differently than they did. But there was still this ability in which to engage each other in a civil manner. And I just don't feel like we've ever seen that since.
I mean, I think this is where the complexity is. I mean, on the one hand, I was thinking about what you said, Bill, a moment ago about the civility in the political class. And I've long maintained and said and written about that. The reason there was civility politically was because the discourse was between white men of means,
right,
in our halls of Congress, in the places where they make political decisions, where they could disagree about conservative liberal issues and different stances on things as deep as war and about economic policy. But in the evening, they would break out their cigars and have a glass of whiskey and slap each other in the back and guffaw together. And I think that's the civility we think of in politically. And I think what you just described, though, also is a different kind of civility that also exists. And it's weird how it exists and what that means for this moment that we're in. I can think of people that I know who I like as human beings, as people who support Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of people I know who are both anti-Semitic and racist, and I see other things who might help me put on my roof, and we can laugh and talk. And when but you don't talk about the other, right? And so, and then there's the political struggle that exists within, around, and around that. And that's where there are so many people who would like to figure out a way, can you bridge that divide? Can you create this conversation that crosses that divide, the divide of race in America that's often within working class, middle class communities? Can you bridge that divide? Can that happen? And I'm thinking about this project that we're working on now around the Poor People's Campaign. And as a veteran of the Poor People's Campaign, as someone who lived in Resurrection City, as someone who organized in some of the most racist white communities to bring poor people to Resurrection City, poor white people, I mean to say, and saw the, what changes they made, that's the end of Mark Steiner that has the hope that you can do something. The other is knowing how deeply divided we are and where we can go. And so, you know, these are the complexities that I've been wrestling with. And I guess wrestling with them anew. I've always wrestled with them, but this is 21st century version of the wrestling match. And I thought about some of the stuff you've been writing, Bill Fletcher, as doing that. I was just going to throw that out to you all and see if I said anything that makes any sense at all in any of that ranging monologue. Bill?
I think, Mark, I am optimistic. But I think that this optimism is tempered by realizing that things could get very, very messy and very, very ugly, as we have seen in the past in the United States. I mean, when people think, for example, about the 1930s, those of us that come out of the trade union movement, we often think about the glorious strikes and battles that took place and the rights that were won. But we frequently don't think about the detention camps that were set up in states like North Carolina and Tennessee to imprison strikers. We don't necessarily think about the lynchings of union organizers. There's things that we tend to forget because we want to mythologize the history of the United States. The way I look at it is we have the numbers. What we don't have is a level of organization and audacity. And the other side does. They also have guns. And that's something that simply can't be underestimated. This so-called alt-right, which is better referenced as neo-fascists, they are armed.
Yes, they are.
You know, and we're going to have to really do some serious thinking about that, because these are people that are not going to be able to be convinced by logic out of their position. But most of the people that we're dealing with don't fall into the camp of the neo-fascists. And the people that you're describing, Mark, some of them may be able to be won over, but others, no. I mean, it's just we're going to have to accept that they're going to remain in their delusional bubble.
So I want to pick up on that theme and ask folks to join us at 410-319-8888 with their thoughts and ideas. So where that – and I think that is true, that some of the right is highly armed. Many – police officers are within that group. They're highly armed. So what does that mean?
But they always were.
That's right.
Does that mean? We'll explore what that means when we come back at 410-319-8888. Let's take a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks, here to our National Roundtable. I'm here with Bill Fletcher Jr., Quincy Gamble, and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, and you all at 410-319-8888. And we were just talking during the break about, you know, does that mean that everyone in America has to become armed to defend and protect themselves from who and what? Do we spiral down to a world of militias? Is the United States Beirut in Lebanon or Syria? I mean, people do think that there are people I've seen who have written about these things, who think about this, that this is where we're sliding to. The numbers of African Americans who are purchasing weapons is higher than it's been in record.
And should be.
And you just said, and should be. So, you know, where does that take us? And I'm trying not to...
Go
ahead, Quincy, what are you going to say?
I think that takes us to a scary place. Granted, there is a notion that we ought to be protecting ourselves, and if our quote enemy has ammunition, then we need the same. But that takes us into a very scary place. And to answer the question that we sort of broached before the break, does Trump come close to being the sort of transformative leader to get us to a moment where those on the right and those on the left can come to a point of mutuality? I can't see it happening under this leadership. So I guess my question would be, what has to happen? What's the next thing that has to happen for us to come together more as a country beyond our political divides? I don't know the answer.
See, Mark, I don't start with bringing the country together. And with all due respect,
no, please go ahead.
Smart. I start with how do we transform the United States, and what I think that means more than anything else is, yes, people are going to have to defend themselves, and I'm adamantly in favor of self-defense, and in that sense, I'm a Second Amendment person, but I don't think that's the main thing to discuss now. In fact, not the main thing to be discussing publicly. I think the main thing to be discussing is how do we build political movements in each of our states that really are transformative? How do we replicate the work of Reverend Barber in North Carolina?
Right.
I mean, how do we conduct that kind of project? There are people like that all over the country. I've been doing work with the labor movement in Washington State, and there's some remarkable things happening out of the trade union movement in conjunction with other movements there that are opposed to the direction that Trump is going and opposed to these neo-fascists. So one of the things that I would put emphasis on is that people that are in opposition to this right-wing maniacal direction need to become self-aware and not thinking that they exist by themselves.
And I think that I'm going to open the phones here. And I think that is a big piece of what we have to talk about. I said during the break here, and we're going to be talking about next hour, which Baltimore has this horrendous murder rate. It's huge. And because people are so dispossessed in this community like they are in New Orleans and other parts of our country. The answer to that is there, and what I was describing the Purpose Campaign is organizing, is people being in communities actually doing the work that transforms that energy into something very different. And I think that's to go along with what you were saying, Bill.
Absolutely.
That's what we have to be doing. Organizing is the key, and I think we have forgotten how to organize.
Oh, we have.
And how to organize effectively as a community. There are groups, I'll give you an example that gives you hope here in Baltimore. It gives me hope. We went down to the climate march. It's a story that we're working on. We're going to share with the public here in a couple of weeks. We went to the climate march, and what struck me at the climate march was the Baltimore contingent. The Baltimore contingent was led by women from the housing projects in Baltimore who are working with Communities United, an organizing project inside of housing projects, fighting for the rights of public housing residents and for communities. When you had that and you had working families, which was mostly black but multiracial group of working families in Maryland, leading that march, that was a turning point to me. I'd never seen that before in my life in all my years of this kind of work. And so I think the key is that kind of bearing down and not really – we spend too much time, which is why we didn't do it today, talking, if I open that way, talking about Donald Trump's tweets and what a madman he is, and not enough time talking about what we have to do.
Correct.
To change things.
I would agree.
That's the problem, I think.
Yeah.
What do our listeners think at 410-319-8888? Sam, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
This is an interesting topic that has been on my mind, I guess, ever since I was a teenager old enough to understand, and I'm getting ready to come upon my 70th birthday very soon.
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
Welcome
and
to the
what
club.
I really wanted to say is, oh, thank you, thank you. I really wanted to add to the conversation that I truly believe we have enough knowledge. I won't say intelligence, because we have professors and we have doctors, but that doesn't mean that you're intelligent. That just means that you have acquired some knowledge. Now, we need to take this knowledge and turn it into intelligence. If we understand the mentality of the enemy, whomever it is, and whatever form it comes in as a human being, then we need to rise above that. That was the one thing that the First Lady said on her way out. When you go low, when someone goes low, you go high. And we haven't done that. As a group of people, we are the most intelligent people on the planet. Now I'm saying intelligent. We're wise. But we need approval from the enemy. This is why we have to move into their communities so that we can be approved. This is why we have to work hard and send our children to their schools so that we can be approved. Why? We already understand what's going on. You know, we got the Harriet Tubmans that came before us. Why can't we placate that? Why do we continue to want approval from some groups of people that we know are the weakest people on the planet, the most fearful people on the planet? And we want to be like them. We want to live where they live. We want to wear what they wear. We want our hair to look like their hair. It's ridiculous. Hair grows in a spiral. Natural hair. It's unnatural for your hair to grow straight. We have to understand that. We have to understand no harm to our brothers, our Caucasian brothers that got caught up into that nonsense. No harm to them. But they got to learn so that they can stop being so fearful and hoarding and being greedy. Okay, because that's what comes out of fear.
Let me let our panel rest what you've been saying. You said a lot, Sam.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your thoughts and ideas and sharing them with us all.
So my initial reaction would be I concur with much of what Sam has raised, but I think one piece that we tend to forget is we always look outside and externally to talk about what other folks are doing and how we're trying to aspire to that. But I think there's another piece that we have to look within and also talk about our own egos and how much they play a part of the decision making we participate in. And so even when we talk about organizing and coalition building, a lot of times that's not happening because of the egos at the table. And that keeps us from getting to the meat and the work that needs to be done in our communities. Instead, we focus on who's at the top and who's being recognized with the particular titles and who is seen to have some sense of assumed power rather than focusing on the work and the end result of where we're trying to get to.
Bill?
See, I think that the I hear what the caller was raising, but I don't think that the major problem is that black folks are trying to imitate white folks. I think that we live in a system that was set up against our interests from the very, very beginning, a system that has played white working people like the strings of a violin.
And continue to do so.
Absolutely. And leads them to believe, because of a differential in treatment, that they are, no matter how badly off, they're going to be better off than the rest of us. And I think that we have to deal with that. I think that that's what Trump and his allies are engaging in. So I would put have a different point of emphasis than the caller.
Before we hit another caller here, Quincy, do you want to respond to Sam, the caller?
I think I agree with a lot of what the caller said, but I would associate myself more with the thinking of what Bill just shared with us. I don't know. I'll tell you, I'm on this call, and I've had a very rough weekend thinking about everything that's going on with Trump. I'm just in a very I'm not in a very pessimistic space on what is in store for the country. So I am just looking to kind of be inspired by some more elevated thinking this morning. I think things are pretty poor off under the leadership of President Trump, and I don't see, even on the progressive side, I don't see a well-articulated, organized, smart approach to accomplishing the things that we are saying that we need to accomplish in order to move forward. So,
I agree with Quincy's point. And my point is, I think some of that is about the egos that are at the table, that I think we have a tendency to want to pretend that that piece doesn't exist in our movements. And what we fail to realize is it's the egos that keep us from actually getting to where we need to get to. So we do need to do some looking within, some soul searching to figure out, what is this about? Why am I at the table? What are your ulterior motives of trying to move forth a movement that's supposed to be for a group of people and not just individuals? And in my personal opinion, I feel like many of us are still stuck on our own positionality and how it impacts us. And that has a lot to do, I don't know what it is about being on Mark's show. He always brings out the socialist in me. But that has a lot to do with the root of capitalism, which promotes and says it's all about the individual, that there is nothing about the group at hand. And if that is the mentality that we are indoctrinated with from the moment we are entering any formalized educational setting, then that's how we as human beings are continuing to reinforce what we're supposed to do as a nation. And so Black folks, like any other group, as any particular group that is trying to move a movement forward, finds itself fixated on, how does this serve me best, instead of how does it serve all of us best?
Let me reopen the phones. 410-319-8888. Cynthia, you're on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. How are y'all today?
Very good. Very good to hear your voice. Welcome.
Okay. I have some comments, and I'm willing to do whatever I got to do to connect with the people. Mm-hmm. One of them is, I think we need to form a business directory just to let everybody know what we're doing right in our community, just like the Baltimore directory that they have with people of color, minority directory. We need a directory, because there's so many people doing things, and we can work in conjunction with each other. There's a lot of people working on the youth, but we definitely need to communicate with the women as well, because there's no need in going back to the youth, getting them in the right position, and they go home in a battle zone. So it's going to be a united effort. That's one thing. The other thing I would like to speak on is the water system has been bugging me. Why these people with these pickup trucks are coming in the city messing with our water? They come in there with tinted windows, and they definitely don't look like us, and all of a sudden there's water problems. We need to check on that. Okay, I watched the thing on the thing they did in Michigan, and found out there was a lot of hanky-panky stuff going on with the water system. We need to be conscious of that, and I would suggest we unite and take pictures of those license numbers of the people who come in there, so if anything does happen, we will have a start. Like they say, take back your community. When they were talking about the Zimmerman case, taking care of your community, we need to get a community first. A community is something that the people own and operate of their own, not someone else telling them what to do. So that's another point I'd like to make.
Okay, then we have to hit another caller here. We have a lot of callers. We can make your last point. Go ahead.
My point is, use the churches, and we need to get together and just get a reference of everybody who's doing something, so we can put something together and stop talking, because the churches are free. The church's grass is getting cut, but nobody's going in the churches on Sunday, so we can utilize those as buildings to do our conversation.
Thank you, Cynthia. Let's hear from Donna. Come back to the panel. Donna, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
Very well. Good morning.
Excellent show. I agree with the last call. We have to get, while we're so busy working with the youth, we're not even talking to the mothers. Because I have friends who work in the mental health field, in the entrenchments of our poor communities, and the mothers are still so disenfranchised and struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder and all the isms that, play into their family. So if we don't start really getting to the root of where these kids are coming from that are angry and out on the streets killing each other, we're not going to solve it. We have to get to the mothers when they first have their babies. We need to start with them, and we need to stay on them. Because if we want to turn back the kids going into bad behavior, we have to start with the mothers first. and then continue from the time they're born. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Donna. I appreciate your words. And you know, Bill Fletcher, before we try to get back to the phones, you get some other thoughts from our listeners, but I think that, and we're going to slide into this in the next hour as we talk about what's going on in Baltimore that's beyond policing. Because I think part of what some of the people are calling is you have to the state of the most dispossessed in America is worse than it's been, I think, since 1865. And the internalized anger that fuels the violence and the pain in the poorest communities, whether they're black communities, whether they are native communities, some Latino communities, even poor white communities. I mean, that to me, the only thing that solves that and saves that is organizing, is bringing people together. You know, I think that's a key word, Bill, that we have to somehow push. That's got to be a broad, united sense of that.
Well, it's organizing, Mark, but also organizing towards transformation. I mean, this
right.
is a moment when radical solutions are common sense. This is not just pie in the sky. What we're up against is so significant that we really do need radical solutions. We need a radical rethinking of the role of government, radical rethinking of taxes and the way taxes are implemented, what's happening with the rich. I mean, one of the things that speaks to the problem that you're identifying is that the gap between those at the bottom and those at the top is so humongous that people at the bottom see no way out. It's short of hitting the number. There's no way out. And this further demoralizes people, drives them into despair. So people have to organize, but they have to organize with a sense that we absolutely have to transform the society. It's not just about getting a new stop sign at the end of our block or even a medical clinic. It really is taking on the system in terms of health care, in terms of housing, in terms of economic development and jobs, in terms of foreign policy. That's the challenge, and in a very odd way, that's why I'm optimistic, because I feel like this is the moment that many of us have been waiting for years.
It is the culmination of the struggle, and I think we've seen historically in America that whenever progress has been made, there's been this push backwards. Really, and this is this push backwards is as hard as the push backwards that killed Reconstruction. And so, but now the difference is there are more people who are conscious than I think ever before in the history of the United States. I'm the younger generation. I use the word woke, which is fine, you know. But so, but I think there are more folks who are woke. There are more people who are white in America who think about race and racism and class than I think, and how those combine than ever before. That's the optimistic side of me too at the moment. There's a force there. And I think, you know, Quincy, in your work, you worked in unions, SEIU, you were, you know, ran political campaigns. You've been in the thick of that establishment political struggle for a long time. And I think that what we have to think about, I think, sometimes is how you build the broadest possible coalition of people to make this change happen.
And well, there is a great...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So there is a great tension in the, quote, progressive movement, especially as it... how it relates to mainstream Democratic politics. I don't envy folks like Tom Perez at all in this moment, in the sense that on one hand, your position to challenge the Trump agenda and fight for Democratic ideals, but at the same time, you're fighting a much more hand-to-hand war with folks who don't believe that the Democratic Party is progressive enough. And so from pure politics, when will we have the space to move forward on this sort of community building, a coalition building, or nation building in a political sense, as long as we're fighting this multi-front battle. That's the great political challenge that we have right now. And I'm not sure there's an easy answer to that.
There is no easy answer, I think, Bill Fletcher, but it also doesn't mean that you have to stop pushing. As you said, I think it's really important to explore, which one of the things you said just a moment ago, is that radical solutions are now common sense.
Sure.
They are. And to build on what Quincy just said, I would actually say I will feel sorry for Tom Perez if what Tom Perez does not do is reach out to the broad array of progressive activists, not simply people who have money, and say, there's a home for you here. Go forth and multiply.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to hear from Perez. I want him to be bringing into the DNC radical voices. I want him to be promoting activism, encouraging it. And when he does that, he's got me as an ally, for whatever that's worth. And I think there's a lot of other people that would be willing to throw down as well. But if he tries to do this in sort of a warmed over way from what we've seen in the past, it will fail.
I think national politics have to be driven by what's happening at the local level. I know that's something Mark and I talk about all the time. I don't think we'll see the dramatic shift in our approach to national politics unless folks are being organized at their district level, at their city level, at their state level. And that sort of gives us a nod to what's going to be happening here in Maryland in 2018. But I just believe that we have to get stronger and better at the local level before we can hope to move our national politics in a different direction.
I also think some of this pushback revolves around religion and faith in our nation. And I mean, I think we saw it in the 2016 campaign and election, the role that being Christian meant something in this nation in a way that has really fortified individuals who embrace their Christianity in this nation in a way that radicalized their politics as well. And so in some respects, I think we do have to deal with that question at the same time that we're trying to organize and figure out the next steps for a more liberal agenda.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that it's a mistake to leave that out of the equation.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think of the movements that happen in this country, they've been based in labor unions. They've been based in a struggle for liberation, like liberation from slavery and segregation and racial oppression. But they have, much of that has also been based in the churches, in the abolition movement, King, the early civil rights movement, in the Catholic left, and what they brought to the table in the 60s. And it's not just Christians. It's Christians and Jews and Muslims and others in the society. I think that you're reaching across these boundaries. We're having a
show. Which is necessary now, but in terms of that vein of what we saw in the 2016 campaign, it was clearly about Christians.
Right.
And them feeling like they were a part of this silent majority that Trump was tapping into. And so what I believe is that while we are talking about grouping and bringing coalition building across religious faiths and beliefs, that there is a need to specifically address what's happening with Christianity, that it has then almost embraced the idea that being to the right is the most Christian stance in which to take in this nation.
Right, right.
But the movement on the right, it's specifically in the 2016 election, was to me more of laying your Christianity to the side, or a perversion of Christianity. There's nothing about the 2016 election from a national perspective that aligns with mainstream Christian views.
Oh, I agree with you. So yes, it is a perversion of Christianity, but it has become the main voice and mainstream of how people are talking about Christianity.
Right.
I would completely agree that it is certainly a perversion of what Christian values are. But now, I mean, similar to what you're suggesting, Bill, with these Twitter debates with right-wingers, I too have found myself engaged, and oftentimes it boils down to that the Christian values are in line with conservative values, and if you are not a conservative, then there's no way for you to be Christian. And that was very much a theme of what we saw happening in the last election.
Let me see if I can get another call in here. Go ahead first, Bill.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the one thing, though, about this election is that the right-wing Christians demonstrated their dishonor by their support of Trump. They completely demolished their own credibility.
Yes.
For very Machiavellian reasons, they were prepared to align themselves with him, but it was clear we were dealing with a candidate whose only relationship to God was that he was created by God.
That is not what Franklin Graham says, though, Bill.
And they sold themselves pretty cheap in the grand scheme of things. When you look at sort of the history of Christianity that's going to be told in the next 1,000 years, this is going to be one of the dark moments of the faith.
Yes, it will be.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm really happy it took the turn it did today. I want to thank all of our guests. Quincy Gamble, good to have you on the phone. Always great to have you with us. Look forward to seeing you soon. And Bill Fletcher, Jr., thank you so much. As always, I really enjoy you as a guest on the show. You bring a lot to it in our discussions. I appreciate it deeply.
Thank you so much.
And Mark, thank you for all that you've done for Baltimore, man. I know that you're going off the air soon, and you have been an indispensable and valuable partner and a leader in this community, and we owe you a great debt of gratitude for all that you contributed to our community. So thank you, brother.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Quincy. I ain't done yet.
That I know.
And Kimberly Moffitt, thank you so much for all you're doing for being here today. Thank you so much. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back from this break, we are going to be looking at what's happening in Baltimore with murder rates rising. But what can be done about it? People are frustrated. People are saying you need more police action, but it's got to be beyond the policing of our community. What do we do? We can't allow this to go on and having our people kill each other. Stay with us. We'll be right back.